Well, we've come back for another week of the Soderstrom bubble. And full disclosure on this week's episode is, shockingly enough, we have audio problems. The microphone, the blue mic that we've been using, the Yeti, not the WCW superstar, but the
that'd
actual...
That'd be weird.
That'd be really weird. Yeti mic is down, and it's an internal problem, so I have to go get it fixed or find another method. So we're using two different methods. One is the audio computer picking up the ambient noise, and two, we've got my Remote Mix C Plus and the Tascam machine, and we're going to see how that works. So...
And if you hear a jingling noise, that's not a malfunction, that's the cat.
Right, kitty? Right, kitty? He's looking at us. So this week, as we said we were going to do, we are going to have some fun with wartime hockey.
Yeah.
As much fun as we can. So, yeah, as we go timeline-wise, 17 to 42, and then 42 started really the depletion of the NHL in terms of guys going off to war, correct?
Yes.
So, I guess start with who were the most, is there one first person that really jumped out that went to war for WW2 that hockey fans will remember very well? Because obviously Ted Lindsay was there, but was he the first one, first notable name of that era to go?
Probably. Of course, you have to consider who was famous then and who was famous
in hindsight.
In hindsight, Conn Smythe was, well, he was in World War I, and apparently he didn't have enough fun then as a prisoner of war, injuries and whatnot. And he started bullying anyone he could into giving him permission to start his own battalion and then lead that battalion into war. And he was well past enlistment age, and he didn't care, and he actually really pressured and bullied other sportsmen into joining his battalion and heading off to war. So that was a big notable effort. He even tried to manage the team from overseas by telegraph and that sort of thing. It was kind of a crazy story. Like, I don't know how he thought he was going to be able to manage a team from the front lines, but he thought it was no problem, so, you know, whatever.
Did that work all that well?
He thought he had been betrayed. There were some moves that were made personnel-wise that he didn't like, and he felt like he'd been stabbed in the back. And so when he got home, he promptly fired some people and took control of the team again. But that's also the kind of person he is. He's that mildly paranoid manager type. So,
with I think you also helped our buddy Anthony with the thing he did with Conn Smythe in that time, didn't you? Like,
yeah,
it's over at Banners on the Wall.
Mm-hmm.
So go to bannersonthewall.wordpress.com, and there's some stuff on the Conn Smythe situation there. So there's that, but I guess list the, like, who are the names that went over? You know, Conn Smythe, Ted Lindsay was one of them. Who else of note went over? Because it seems like during that era, a lot of guys were willing to go off to war.
They were very willing, and it was their patriotic duty, as they saw it, to go. Let's see, who else went? Howie Meeker went. He was a Calder winner. Good player. And then longtime commentator on CBC, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
There was Johnny Bauer, who lied about his age to enlist.
Mm-hmm. A lot of guys lying about their age.
Yeah. Maurice Richard tried, I believe, 3 or 4 times to enlist, and they turned him down every time. One of the consistent reasons they gave him was that he was kind of and this is a medical technical term, he was kind of a splody bones. You know, he would hit the net, or he would hit the crossbar physically during practice or during a game, and he'd break his arm. He would trip and, you know, break his ankle. He would, like, so he
was a pre-day Joffrey Leupold.
Yeah, and then he went on to have this amazing NHL career, but at that point, he was simply seen as too fragile. And they also thought he wasn't educated enough, so he worked as a machinist. Let's see, who else? The Kraut line from the Bruins. That's the really famous one that everyone loves to talk about, is Milt Schmidt, Woody Dumart, and who's the third one? I'm blanking out on it now. Bobby Bauer. That's who it was. They all went off to the RCAF, the Royal Canadian Air Force, and the thing everybody loves to talk about with them is that their final game before shipping out for training was against the hated rival Habs, and at the end of the game, the three of them plus the goalie all got carried off the ice on the team, on the various players' shoulders, Habs and Bruins alike, and there's a clip of it on NHL.com. You can find it pretty easily. What they don't really tell you, though, is that the three of them didn't go off to combat. They went off to military jobs as, like, physical instructors. I believe it was Milt Schmidt who, his job was to teach pilots how to jump into an icy pool while hanging on to this inflatable raft thing, inflate the raft and get into the raft safely in a certain amount of time because, you know, the Atlantic is an icy, cold ocean. So his job was important, and, you know, physical training obviously was important too, but a lot of the NHL guys didn't really end up seeing combat.
Where did they mostly get deployed to? Did they stay, I guess, domestically, or did they go off into, like, your... I would assume a lot of the Canadian guys went to Europe, of most places. I don't know about the U.S. guys.
They went, well, it depends. The NHL guys who enlisted in Canada, and at that point most of them were Canadian, so obviously they enlisted in Canada, they were given assignments similar to the Kraut lines. They were all working in physical instruction, or some of them were playing hockey on exhibition teams, military exhibition teams, and they did so in Great Britain. They did so in Canada. Yeah, not a lot of them. And I think that was sort of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge arrangement where possible, where you're going to enlist and you're going to serve. But we're going to put you someplace at least sort of safe. But then, of course, you have the guys who said, heck no, I'm getting into the battle. Guys like Conn Smythe. Guys like Johnny Bauer, who lied to enlist. Johnny Bauer, I don't think was... I think he was only 16 when he enlisted. And he should not have survived the war because he was assigned to Princess Patricia's, I believe. And they were assigned a D-Day invasion. And Bauer and several other guys in his unit were sick, horribly sick, with some sort of chest and throat infection. And so they went to the infirmary instead of off to the invasion. And most of the guys in the invasion didn't survive. They were captured. They were killed in action. And if he hadn't been sick, he would have been right there with them, which is kind of a wild thought. Like, you know, there but for a chest infection, you might not have ever heard of Johnny Bauer. So, and the invasion was in Normandy. That's where it was.
Usually is for D-Day.
Well, it was a pre-D-Day.
Oh, okay.
It was like 1942.
It was the early screenings of D-Day.
Yeah, it was the early, like, test
attempts. It was the test run at Saving Private Ryan. I gotcha.
Yeah.
And you mentioned a lot of Italian teams over there, correct? Mm-hmm. Like, there was a lot of just... Was that just... kind of a blow off steam, kind of de-stressor for these guys and what they knew. That's just like, all right, we can play hockey. Let's play hockey. If we can play hockey, hockey.
For some of the guys, and for some of them, they were on the team as ringers, you know, because military competitions were fairly fierce. Still are, I imagine. Plus, there were, you know, morale games that they were ordered to be a part of across Canada and in England. So that was their kind of their job, basically. It was to play in these tournaments, win these tournaments, and then morale booster.
Interesting. So it wasn't like their league teams, or that they didn't have a team that played in a specific league or anything like that.
No, aside from I want to say the Coast Guard team.
Yep.
There isn't one I can think of.
That's what I was leading into, and that was the one team I think of all the U.S. military that played during that time was the Coast Guard Bears/Cutters.
Mm-hmm.
So we were also Bears. started off, and then the Cutters was 42-43, and they were, man, they were dominant in the EHL, the Eastern Hockey League. And they are part of Maryland hockey history since they played their games at Carlins Iceland in Baltimore, even though they're based out of Curtis Bay, Dearhorn. Curtis Bay, just right there. You go down there, you got the soccer complex there. It'd be great times. You get right there, Carlins there. Go down and watch the hockey. A Orioles own. They don't play the hockey no more because of the wartime, don't you know? So
wasn't that arena the one with the big wooden facade?
I don't know if Carlins was. I think Carlins was more like the dome.
Oh, okay.
Dome piece.
I just remember one from that era had that really great like wooden facade, and I couldn't remember.
It could have been Carlins
too,
but Carlins burned down, so yeah. That's why the Clippers had to move that one time. So. But there were a lot of notable names there. So the one notable name from the Cutters was...
Oh, I don't...
Frank Brimsek, Mr. Zero.
Oh, yes.
Neil Francis apparently was part of this, too. So, St. Louis Brews president, they said he was strafed by the Cutters while attending gold for the Philadelphia Falcons. So he faced the Cutters and he said, and I quote... There was nothing like them before or since, dominating the EHL. A lot of sellouts too.
Mm-hmm. They were a very popular team.
And then was that, I guess, a patriotic thing? You would have to think.
Partly, and partly because a lot of the guys who normally would have been playing went off to war.
Mm-hmm.
So who you had left versus the talent you saw in the Cutters team. Was worth watching. I mean, you know, if you were a fan of the Bruins and you couldn't go to a Bruins game, but hey, Frank Brimsek's in town with the Cutters, you know, it's...
Now, with that situation there, how many teams, like, if we want to dial it back from the world, like, how many of these teams were really just decimated by... people going off to war, and how many was it Canadian versus American? Because, you know, there at that time there probably wasn't that many American born players who were of the stardom acclaim,
right?
But like I mean, how many NHL teams were ravaged by this?
NHL teams not so much, because a lot of the players had jobs that outside jobs that were considered essential labor.
Hmm.
And so they got the waivers to not have to enlist and not be called up and all of these things. So the NHL teams, not so much. It's the fringe guys that got hit pretty hard. It's the AHL guys that got hit pretty hard. The teams were weakened, no doubt. That's just a flat-out fact, to the point where... that's you have a rookie coming in who's 16 years old into the NHL because they're that desperate for call-ups and fill-ins.
Any kind of warm bodies, essentially.
Yeah, basically.
Huh, interesting. Like, is that where you get the era of guys who are just the youngest player of all time because they needed that player?
Yeah, because it was a freak coincidence of time and place, I guess. Mm-hmm.
Circumstance.
Yeah. For example, the Detroit team didn't get hit too hard, but that's because most of them had side jobs in, you know, manufacturing, like the auto industry, or which had switched over to you know, aircraft or tanks or whatever, or jeeps or whatever. They were machinists and they were working day jobs, and they actually wore a patch on their sweaters for a year, a war bonds patch.
So the first advertisement.
Yeah, basically.
The first advertisement of NHL sweaters, and people were just like, "That's not the old hockey I know with no advertising." Yeah, they advertised on sweaters. You dinguses.
To buy war bonds.
Buy war bonds, stupid.
Yeah.
So guess what? You can't complain about ads on jerseys because they happened in the 40s, so suck it.
The NHL president at the time was...
Kennesaw Mountain Landis. No, that was baseball.
It was Red Dutton, who served in World War I, saw action on the front, was injured, recovered, went on to his playing career, and then he was involved with the New York/Brooklyn Americans. And he was trying to run them, and he was the temporary president of the NHL. And the NHL screwed him over a little bit because of the war and because of the rent issue with Madison Square Garden. He wanted to suspend operations of the team for the duration of the war. And the NHL said, okay. And then after the war, he said, okay, you know, let's start up the Americans again. And the NHL went, say, what now? They really treated him badly. In the end, and not only was he a World War I vet, he lost two of his sons during World War II while he was serving as NHL president, and he lost them within 6 months of each other, and they were both killed in action. So, you know, it was a really rough time for him. Games themselves were, they were used as collection points for things like donated mittens for soldiers. They put out an appeal once for binoculars, and the collection point was hockey games. You go to the game, you drop off your binoculars, you get, like, I don't know, 5 cents off your ticket or something. You know, the usual sort of...
kind of like we do today with canned goods and things like that, right?
Right, right. Or it's, you know, drop off a pair of binoculars, enter to win a prize for, you know, that sort of thing. Well, the problem was they didn't need to offer those sorts of things because these drives were so popular at hockey games that they had to put out another announcement that said, stop, please, for the love of God, stop. We have too many. Stop. If you went to a game, it was your patriotic duty to return the puck to the ice.
Mm-hmm. Not to waste rubber.
Yeah, because of the rubber shortage. So there are all sorts of interesting little things going on. Overtime? No overtime? That went away. I can find the exact date. I know because I have it, because I'm a nerd. November 21st, 1942 is when overtime ended, and it did not come back until October 8th, 1983, in a new and different form.
Interesting. So 42 to 83, 41 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that includes the expansion era, too.
Yeah.
How about that? But that, and that was just regular season, too, right? Like, that was
right.
Playoff time and stuff like that. Interesting.
Yeah. And
God, I didn't think it was that long.
You know, nobody realizes it was that long. We just sort of assume that overtime was always.
Yeah, like you didn't think after the third period it stops dead. Okay. Well, fair enough.
I was really confused. I went to my first college game and they didn't have overtime. And I was really confused. I was like, the game just ends?
Yeah, it's an odd situation, huh?
Yeah.
Back on the Coast Guard, I'm looking at this. The Coast Guard hockey has, and the military have a nice little history of the Cutters. And they were drawing crowds of 12,000 people, but they were forced to break up because people were upset that everyone else was off deployed to war, and these guys were home side playing hockey.
Yeah.
So despite winning a couple championships in the Eastern League, which a lot of people said was super competitive at that time, and drawing so many crowds, it didn't matter. I mean, the Coast Guard was forced to break them up after the 43-44 season.
Well, and I think that's... There were a lot of soldiers' parents who were very upset.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why does your kid get to stay here and be safe and play hockey, and my kid died? And that's a lot of pressure to be hearing, especially at that point in the war. So, except 40, 44?
Yep.
45? 44. 44. Yeah. So, that was just politics and pressure. And, you know, it is kind of a valid question. Why do you get to stay here safe and sound and my kid doesn't?
Mm-hmm.
You know? that's always a tough one to argue back and forth.
Well, of course. And one of the Cutters, they played the Red Wings. January 6th, your birthday.
Yes.
1944. Just a couple years before you were born.
Hey!
Capacity nice. Crowd in Balmer. Brimstick was in goal. They trailed 4-3
mm-hmm.
by the time of third period. Then the Red Wings were just smarter and shellacked them 8-3 at the end. So these things happen. But I wonder if that was not, you know, it's like, oh, one of those things is like people say, oh, the Stanley Cup champion played this minor league team or this other league team. But considering the popularity of the Cutters, I wonder mm-hmm. if the NHL didn't get that just so they can get some exposure for their own guys. I mean, you have to wonder which way the pendulum swings in that instance there. Because if you're getting over 12,000 a night and the NHL isn't getting that much, why wouldn't you do a promotional thing like this before promotions were a huge ordeal?
Yeah. There's really no reason not to. And plus, I think you have some former players on the Cutters. So it's not like it's a complete amateur team. It's you've got several.
Yeah, there was Brimsek there. They had Art Cloutier, Adam Motor, or Alex Motor, Red Wings. Art Cloutier was former captain of the New York Rangers. Johnny Mariucci, Manny Cotlaw, and you know, just a lot of just different guys that actually played in the NHL or, mm-hmm. or were playing in the NHL at the time this whole thing happened. So yeah, it wasn't like it was a ragtag bunch of fellers. It was just, you know, guys who actually knew what to do they were doing and knew how to play in the NHL system.
Yeah, so. And it's a novelty. It's win-win publicity
mm-hmm.
for both teams. So why
and
not
it counts
do it?
As dry land training, so helps everyone else after that. And let the you know, going back to the NHL, that created for a hell of a war for players too. Like you mentioned about the call ups and everything like that, but mm-hmm. guys getting traded because of need and guys, you know, going this, that, and the other thing. Like that must have been a hell of a ordeal for these teams in turn. In a, I guess, free agent, I guess if you want to call it that, or just trying to get bodies.
Yeah, because you didn't really have a whole lot of great call-up options because they were all off at war, or the majority of them were off at war, you know. So your call-up might be a guy who's been on the AHL team for, you know, 6 or 7 years, and he's been there for a reason.
Yeah. And let's not be mistaken here. Like, this is during a time where the AHL was trying to be its own entity as well.
Yeah. I mean,
granted, in 1938, they kind of signed an agreement saying that they wouldn't go against the NHL. But, there, you know, we had, and we'll tackle this topic, I say we do it next week since we're doing the production. We do the inter-squad or the inter-league drafts.
Yeah.
Because those are always interesting, especially when we go into an expansion era. But
and then there's the whole farm system thing.
And then the farm system thing started.
Territorial rights.
But and I think the farm system was more of a junior league thing than it was AHL thing, because that's when you had guys who were signed to different contracts and things of that ilk in nature. So we'll get into that in time as well. So once the war had ended, at what point did it turn to any kind of business as usual for the NHL? Or did it?
It did pretty quickly, actually. It's almost like everyone wanted to just put the war behind them and move on.
Mm-hmm.
So they did the best they could. They just wanted back to normal quickly as possible.
I'm sure everybody did at that point in time.
Yeah.
So, any... I guess the losses of those, like, who was any big loss during war for NHL players? Were there any notable, I guess?
There were definite notable injuries.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said before, Howie Meeker. He was injured in a training accident. I think it was supposed to be a dud grenade, like a training grenade. It turned out not to be. And he ended up with shrapnel in his leg, and they told him he'd be lucky if he ever walked again. And 2-3 years later, he was winning the Calder as a rookie, as an NHL rookie. But other than that, not really. Okay, that's a lie. There are two I should mention. Or three I should mention, maybe. Het Kilray. He got a Distinguished Service Cross, Purple Heart, French Croix de Guerre for his service. There was... Conn Smythe was injured, actually. An ammunitions dump blew up, and he happened to be near it. Sam Lopresti. That was a wild story. I don't know all of the details of it. I've never been able to find a whole lot of the details about it, but he was serving on a naval supply ship that was torpedoed, sank. He and several other servicemen ended up on a raft for 40-plus days. And the only reason they stayed alive, apparently, is because Lopresti was smart enough to, lure and kill either a shark or a dolphin. I can't remember off the top of my head, but one of those two. The point is, it was a large sea animal, and he was able to kill it, and they were able to survive by eating it.
Huh.
So.
You can kill a whale. I don't want to deal with that. Hockey rink, that's for damn sure.
Yeah. But that's how he survived. And then there was one who was a prisoner of war. I'll find his name in just a second here. Bob Carse played for the Blackhawks. He was the only pro player to end up as a prisoner of war in World War II.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. The lower ranks were hit pretty hard. The notable examples are Joe Turner, Red Tilson. All right, let me start with Red Tilson. Red Tilson was an Oshawa Generals player, pretty talented. He was the scoring champion, so obviously he was pretty talented. He was killed in action in Holland in 1944. The OHL named their MVP award for him. Joe Turner... Is that the IHL?
Yep.
Joe Turner was a goalie. He played, I believe, one NHL game. And played the rest of his time in the lower leagues. And he was killed in action. And they named the championship, the IHL championship trophy, after him. Red Garrett was a Rangers rookie defenseman. He was killed in action. And they named the AHL named their top rookie award for him as well. Probably one of the most decorated players coming out of the lower leagues was Augie Hirschenrotter. He was a platoon leader, and he and his platoon, his platoon took over a town. They took back a town, I should say, from the Germans, and he was awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, Legion of Honor, that sort of thing. I'm not sure what else he was awarded, but yeah, those are some of the more notable deaths and accomplishments.
So, and it seems that after World War II, that's kind of when the involvement kind of left. I mean, there was not really many... For any other wars, Korea, Vietnam, Gulf, anything like that? Was that just were they exempt from it? Were they excused? Did it just not get to their numbers didn't get called? Like, was that just luck of the draw?
A lot of it was they're Canadian.
Mm.
They was still 75% Canadian for a long, long time. It was still a Canadian majority league. So they were exempt from any sort of American military action.
Well, I didn't know if Canada got into a lot of these fracases or not.
They did, but more as supply and support.
Mm.
So doctors, nurses.
So their numbers were very minimum, and they were very specialty people.
Yeah, okay. Generally speaking, you had to be of a certain type of training and that sort of thing.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
Final thoughts on this? Like, what is the takeaway in this? Like, especially in this era, leading up to it was just after a lot of teams started finishing, just as the quote unquote original six, the remaining six teams, as it were. Like, it seemed to be like with all the teams disbanding and things like that, that this could have been a huge, huge hit to the NHL.
Mm.
Had like a lot of these guys, you know, perished or if, you know, teams were very depleted because of this, even if they shut down the season because they had so many players, because I think it was like 80 hockey players or 80 players in the NHL or something like that.
They think that between the NHL and the AHL, there were 100 and I want to say 115,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, considering every team only carried
probably 14, maybe 15.
15 guys? That's a lot.
Yeah.
You know? But the thing that pisses me off is that when people say, oh, well, you have to adjust for the weakness of the era. It's like, no, you don't, because the whole point of a team sport is to adapt and overcome and, you know, figure out how to put the pieces together. And it's, I don't know how to explain how it pisses me off, but, like, it was a war. Like, of course there's going to be depletions, but at the same time, you can't knock the things that were happening in the league. Like, you still had a scoring champion with very respectable numbers. You still had goalies with, you know, really great save percentages. It's not like the league fell apart. It's not like it was amateur hour in the league. So I guess I would like people to stop treating it as if it was some sort of, I don't know, just stop treating it as if it was some sort of amateur hour show that was going on, because it wasn't.
All right. Worked for me then. All right, so there's that. Book review? Do you have a book you want to review? Is there a book offhand that you... We just got Architectures on Ice, so that's a... That seems like a hoss of a read, so you'll have to give me a high-speed lowdown. I'll just look at the pictures.
It is, because it's kind of academic. It's a museum book, basically.
It's like an engineering situation.
Yeah, and he's talking about how these are the sorts of functional buildings that were never really meant to be architecturally famous or, you know,
right.
or anything. But at the same time, they're used by everyone.
Mm-hmm.
They're very utilitarian.
Okay, so we'll get to that.
Yeah.
In a bit, after you read that. I'm looking at our bookshelf. I'm looking at my side of the bookshelf, because I can't look at yours. There's too many. might as well. I'm trying to find what book is that one. You haven't read the Terry Ryan book yet, have you?
I have not.
You read The Instigator? The Bettman book?
No. Yes, but it was a while ago when you loaned it to me.
Yeah.
The last one that I read that sticks out in my head is the Bobby Orr biography,
okay.
or autobiography. Oh, Lord. People are going to hate me for this.
No, this is the autobiography. This isn't...
This is his newest book.
This isn't the one Stephen Brunner wrote, In Search of Bobby Orr, right?
No.
Have you read that one?
I have. I like that one better. Far better. Bobby Orr is a very private person, and it comes through in this book. There's nothing wrong with this book. It's a very tepid book, I guess. Like, literally, if you
As
could
most
make...
most autobiographies kind of are.
If you could make hockey player cliches into a book form, that would be a
that
lot
That wasn't of, a quote book?
Yeah, that wasn't a quote book. That would be this book, because he talks about, you know, growing up and having... happy family, and how he shot pucks at the garage at his house, and, you know, just very, there's no special anecdote in there, you know, like, there's no wacky story, like, well, I wanted to be like my hero, so, you know, there's just, oh gosh, hard work, ah shucks, more hard work, and, you know, teamwork, and that's kind of how the whole book goes. Is
how many pages is this?
Oh, it was 200 and some.
It seems like it's about 150 too long.
Yeah. I mean, you cannot learn anything from that book that you did not already know about him. Or, I mean, it's meant to be intimate without actually being intimate, if that makes sense. Like, here's a look at my life, but I'm going to show it to you through these, you know, three panes of glass. Mm. So it's a very nice book, and it does have some advice for young players. It's a very gentle book. There's no swearing in it. There's no...
No big stories?
No, like, big stories.
Hmm. It seems kind of bland. I'm not going to lie to you.
It was a very bland book. I was quite disappointed.
Hmm.
So... Yeah, I thought maybe just this once, you know, there'll be a really great Bobby Orr story, and no.
Not so much.
Not so much.
Well, that's a shame.
He's a great player, great person, just too private to make this worth your while.
Huh.
Unless you're looking for some advice on, you know, being a 15-year-old hockey player.
And you can't do it. Like, honestly, it's one of those things like Gretzky coaching.
Well, Orr is an agent now.
Yeah, but at the same time, it's like you can't teach the kind of greatness that he was either. It's like,
no, and most of his advice is things like, you know, work hard, make sure everyone gets their credit, and, you know.
Even his advice is cliches.
It really is.
Jesus.
Yeah. And I remember reading it and thinking, well, that's really nice. And then, wait a second, did he just tell me to keep my head up but take a paragraph and a half to do it?
Yeah.
You know, like, so, yeah, I was very disappointed by the Bobby Orr book.
Mm.
And the last time I said that, people screamed at me, he's the greatest player ever. Okay, being a great player has nothing to do with this
great book. Player, terrible writer. Like, there's plenty of those. Yeah. There's terrible players that are terrible writers. So I'll give you the Terry Ryan book for that. Because that one, Jesus Christ. Like, sure, it's a funny book.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's nice little, like, jabs here and there. But, my God. Like, yeah. You want to talk about a guy who's putting himself over in a big way.
Mm.
Oof. Oof.
Yuck.
Oof. You would love it, just the absurdness of it.
I'll try not to throw it because it's your book and not mine. But
it's paperback. It'll bounce. Like, I'm ever going to read that twice again. There's very few books that I read twice. I barely read things once. So, yeah. All right, do you have a Black History Month player that you want to talk about?
Let's see. We said we weren't going to do the obvious famous ones. So how about the one I always tell people when they ask me online is a guy named Alton White. He played mostly in the WHA. He was a great scorer, though. He's from Amherst, Nova Scotia.
A lot of Nova Scotians that are, you know, that seem, or a lot of black players go to the East Coast.
Well, you know why, right?
Yeah, because of the All Black Hockey League.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because that's where a lot of the slaves settled.
Yeah.
Or freed slaves, I should say.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mostly where they settled, so. Yeah.
Makes sense.
That's why you have a big black community there and why they produced a bunch of hockey players. He played three seasons with the New York Raiders, LA Sharks, Michigan Stags / Baltimore Blades. He's the second player of African descent to play in a professional hockey league. The first one to score 20 goals in a single season. And he became the first black player in history to score a hat trick.
Huh.
So, yeah, usually when people ask me, who's a little-known black player, and I always go right for Alton White, because nobody really remembers him. I think he should have been able to make the leap to the NHL. It just didn't happen.
Mm.
But...
Is that politics?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Partly pettiness, partly racism. I mean, there weren't any other black players in what was this, 70...
That'd probably be early 70s.
Yeah, early 70s. So, you know, it's partly politics. It's partly pettiness. Just you know, WHA versus NHL, and partly racism. So.
Next week, Tyrone Gardner.
Okay.
Because that guy's got a story. He's a newer guy, kind of came on the scene in the 90s, but his story about, you know, transition not only in life as a hockey player, but positionally as a hockey player is quite the story itself. Mm. So we'll talk about Tyrone Gardner next week. Anything else we got to take care of? We're at 41 minutes here. And that's full running time after edits and trying to figure out which audio, the computer audio or the Tascam audio, sounds better.
The only other thing we could talk about is our little week in review.
I didn't have a week. We talked about wrestling last week, and then I haven't done anything since because I wasn't working.
I had surgery.
Yeah, that's right. You had face surgery.
Yeah, that was super fun.
Still can't blow your nose for another like week.
No, it's making me insane. And then I sneezed today, and oh.
But you saw John Wick too.
I did. I saw John Wick.
John Wick also.
Yes. John Wick the second. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So my face is kind of weird, swollen, achy. Mm.
It's killing me.
As usual.
All right. All right, going out of a high spot here, kids. All right. So next week, I guess we'll talk about the years leading up to expansion.
Mm-hmm.
The rumblings of expansion, and then interleague drafts.
Yes.
We can talk about, I guess, the advent. Because I think that happened mostly in the 50s and 60s.
60s. Yeah.
So it'll be around that time, pre-expansion and things like that. Yeah. That's where we have to put our I bought whiteboard sheets. And that's where we put it up, just ideas to talk about for the show.
There's all sorts of things, because you have the original Six Era, which I hate calling it that, but... Mm-hmm. And then you have the farm system that they had with the C forms that they were mm-hmm. getting kids to sign, and the AHL competition, and...
There was a time a lot of people said that AHL was better than the NHL, so...
Well, and for a period it was.
Yeah.
So, and then the first drafts... started in the 1960s. So.
And then that's how the Montreal Canadiens stacked their teams.
No, not really.
Mm.
That is a falsehood that we can discuss.
What do you mean it's a falsehood? They got first two picks every year and they won the Stanley Cup the year before.
That's because, well, no, A, the whole first pick of French players only lasted, I think, 3 or 4 years. And B, their general manager was just a goddamn genius. Like, to the point where other GMs hid from him, so he couldn't persuade them to make these trades.
What are they doing? Buying him dinner and then giving him a reach around? Like, there's no way a businessman is that smart. I've dealt with businessmen. They're not that smart.
Sam is a legend.
Mm. All right, well, we'll talk about that. And much, much less next week.
Mm.
Jen, they can find you where?
NHL History Girl.
You can find me at Scotty Hawes, and this is part of the Face Off Hockey Show Network. So this has been the Soderstrom Bubble. Audio terrible. Hopefully it'll be better next week. And if not, well, deal with it. we'll have to do like a remastered version. The HD remix afterwards. So, all right, that's it. That's all for Jen. I'm just going to take care of yourself and someone else. This has been the Soderstrom Bubble and the Face Off Hockey Show Media Network. We'll see you guys next week. Bye.